Hello, I'm Veronica Skiersbrick. I'd like to join a church historian from the University of Virginia, currently visiting professor at Fordham University. He's a Jesuit, and his name is Gerald Fogarty. I spoke to him earlier in the week, and he was kind enough to give me an overview of the whole Roman question, my effort to mark the 80th birthday of Vatican City State. Stay tuned.
I'd just like to set the scene. The year is 1870, right? And the place is Rome's Porta Pia, one of the gates of the city. The Italian troops enter Rome at the time of the unification of Italy. This brings about the fall of the Papal States and the loss of temporal power for the Pope. What did this entail for the Pope at the time, who was Blessed Pius the Ninth now, and consequently for the Catholic Church?
Well, it was a twofold thing. Number one, in 1872, the Italian Parliament did pass the Law of Guarantees, which gave certain rights to the Pope. But nevertheless, that was a unilateral decision by the Italian Parliament. Technically, they could repeal it. It was not bilateral, withstanding an international law. So it did mean the Pope became the prisoner of the Vatican. The second thing was there was always the danger, by not having any type of temporal power to guard the spiritual sovereignty of the Holy See, it meant there was always the danger of the popes being cut off from his correspondence with his bishops. So those were the two main effects during the period that's known as the Roman Question until 1929.
You mentioned the fact that the Pope was a prisoner in the Vatican, but it was of his own will that he was a prisoner in the Vatican. He didn't have to be there.
No, but that was one of the things that this way he was refusing to recognize the sovereignty of the Italian government over the city of Rome. By remaining only in the Vatican Palace and the Vatican grounds, he therefore was making a statement. That's why he personally became the prisoner of the Vatican. You're right. It was his decision.
Am I right in saying that Pope Pius IX may no longer have been head of the sovereign state, but continued acting and speaking for the whole church through the Holy See in continuity with early Christian times? In that sense, nothing changed.
Yeah, nothing changed, because he still spoke as head of the church, as head of the Holy See, the Diocese of Rome. And when a diplomat is accredited to the Holy See, they are accredited to the Pope as the head of the church, not to the sovereignty of the state of Vatican City, and certainly not to the state of the Holy See, as some recent diplomat said. But it does mean that the Pope continued to address the whole world in his capacity as head of the church.
This situation with the Pope then as a voluntary prisoner in the Vatican stalled right from the papacy of Pius IX through to those of Leo XIII, Pius X, Benedict XV. And their pontificates cover 52 years, no?
And halfway through the pontificate of Pius XI. There were some efforts, for instance, at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. There were some overtures. Arrangements were made by an American priest, Francis Kelly, with the Italian government, and there were some preliminary meetings that took place at that time, 1919. And in fact, when the Lateran treaties were signed 10 years later, there was an allusion made to the early work that was done by this priest and one Italian diplomat. But for the most part, there were no real overtures. There were two things that happened. One was, in the 1890s, you had these cardinals called the conciliationists, who were working for conciliation. And they were willing to accept what became the present boundaries of Vatican City State. But there were other cardinals opposed, and so were members of the Italian government at the time, of actual recognition of a temporal sovereignty to guard the spiritual sovereignty. I use those terms, Veronica, because people get confused sometimes. The purpose of this little tiny state of 103 acres, I think it is to protect the spiritual sovereignty and authority of the Pope, so that he is not subject to the whims of any particular government. And if he is in any way persecuted, then there's a legal standing. But anyway, people get confused on that.
So then things changed in 1922, when after 52 years, Pius XI became Pope. And as soon as he was elected, he made an unexpected gesture and stepped out onto the balcony towards the Italian state.
That's
which is
right.
Something that hadn't been happening for 52 years. So
That's
it was
right.
A momentous gesture.
Yeah.
It was the first in a long line of decisive gestures, no?
His gesture, Urbi et Orbi. Urbi et Orbi, because this had not been done since the fall of Rome. And incidentally, Pius XII, when he was crowned, would pick up on this, because although some critics say that his coronation took place with greater pomp than anything in the previous 70 years, they are absolutely correct, because this was the first coronation of a pope after the end of the Roman question. It could be done with all the pomp, in other words. Now, they played it down more since then, but nevertheless, this was a gesture on the part of the newly elected Pius XI, who had a diplomatic background. He had been nuncio to Poland and then became Archbishop of Milan. So he did have a different type of background than a lot of other folks who were elected, although by training he was really a librarian.
I mean, when Pius XI became pope, it was at a particular time in history. Mussolini had marched on Rome in 1922, no?
Yes. Yes, the fascist government was taking over. And there were compromises being made, for instance, in 1926. The Partito Popolare was banned. But that had to do with a number of issues. It had to do not only with pressure from the fascists, but also pressure from some cardinals as well who were pro-fascist, and they saw the Partito Popolare under the priest Luigi Sturzo as inhibiting some type of settlement of the Roman question. Also, Pius XI, when he looked at Catholic Action, he demanded that Catholic Action take place under the direction of the local bishop, and the Partito Popolare was an independent movement. It was a political party. So there were a number of things, compromises that the Pope himself made in preparation for what happened 80 years ago.
Well, what happened 80 years ago then exactly? It was the 11th of February, 1929. Yeah. Is that right?
That's right. Finally signed the Lateran Treaty, the concordat between the two entities. The Lateran Treaty guaranteed the creation of Vatican City State, the spiritual sovereignty of the Holy See, therefore. The concordat regulated relationships between the church and the Italian government within Italy. And then finally there was an agreement, a third pact that was signed in regard to financial remuneration and so forth. So this definitively ended the Roman question. Signed for the Holy See by Pietro Gasparri, then the Secretary of State, and signed by for the Italian government by Benito Mussolini, the Prime Minister.
And they're called the Lateran Pacts because they took place in the Lateran.
That's right. The Lateran Basilica is the cathedral for the Bishop of Rome. St. Peter's Basilica is not a cathedral. I correct people on that all the time. You have the Bishop's Chair for the Diocese of Rome in the Lateran, and attached to it is the Lateran Palace, and that's where the negotiation and final signing took place.
What did this imply for the Catholic Church at a universal level?
The little plot of land was to guard the spiritual sovereignty of the Pope and his communications with the Church throughout the world. Way back in the 1860s, just as an aside, some of the great liberal leaders of France, like Montalembert, argued that the Catholic Church could be free nowhere unless there was a Catholic state somewhere. So he supported temporal power at the time, and though he was seen as a great liberal. Yet this is a thing that people don't seem to realize. In order to guarantee the spiritual autonomy, authority, freedom of communication, and so forth, of the Pope, there had to be some type of Catholic state guarding that. So therefore they created Vatican City State in 1929. So that was the significance for worldwide Catholicism.
Pius XI had trouble in leaving the Vatican for a long time, didn't he?
Yeah, he finally would go to Castel Gandolfo. One time he went there early was in 1938 when Hitler was visiting Rome. So the Pope went out to his summer villa in May, normally doesn't go until late June or July, and in 1938 he made a point of getting out there early. But you're right, the papal villa of Castel Gandolfo, just a little bit south of Rome, that was part of the Lateran Treaty guarantee that that would still belong to the Pope, and he would enjoy extraterritoriality. It was sort of like an embassy, but actually the territory eventually was actually slightly larger than that of the Vatican itself, Vatican City State. But he still hesitated to go out.
The Italian state offered a larger territory, no? It was turned down within the Leonine walls, no?
Yeah, they did. Basically, what is now Vatican City State is, I believe, the limits of the approach of the forces of the Kingdom of Italy in 1870. Italian generals stopped right there. whereas you do have the wall that runs out to the Castel San Angelo, which is a passageway where the Pope could escape to the fortress in case, as he did in 1527. But there were several negotiations going on in regard to the extent of this Vatican territory. But the Vatican City was already closed in by these walls. And nevertheless, in the Lateran Treaty, they do say that Vatican City technically starts at the steps of the Basilica, because the square had been open for so many centuries by that point. You know, the Vatican, St. Peter's Square, got to be from Pietro.
You mentioned Pius XI going to Castel Gandolfo when Hitler came to Rome. Was that to avoid Hitler, meeting Hitler?
Oh, very definitely. He ordered the Vatican museums closed. He said, well, it was sort of implied that if Hitler asked for an audience, he may get one, but it was doubtful. But just in case he did want one, the Pope took off for Castel Gandolfo, which meant that it was going to be difficult for Hitler to go there. And then he met a number of newly married people, and he talked about what a disgrace it was over the eternal city where the cross of Christ is present to have this eruption of a cross, the swastika flying up from almost every public building. So, no, it was done very much on purpose. Remember, this was a year after Mitrenor de Zurga, which the Pope had signed, but it was drafted by five German bishops and Pacelli, mainly drafted by Faulhaber of Munich, and it was a condemnation of National Socialism. Relations were very strained between the Holy See, the Catholic Church in general, and Nazism at that time.
Papa, by becoming an independent state, Vatican City had acquired the right to communicate directly with other states. That's why the Pope, the day after the signing of the Lateran Pacts, entrusted Marconi with the task of setting up our own radio station here.
For any American listeners, but it's interesting, when the Pope broadcast his first message...
12th of February 1931.
Well, it was translated into English and broadcast by Monsignor Francis Thelman, who later became the Archbishop of New York. But that was negotiated, and that was one of the things that was made possible by the Lateran Treaty, was that there could be a wireless system. And 2 years later, Vatican Radio came into being.
One last question. In 1984, I think, the Concordat was revised, wasn't it?
Yes, and ratified by the Italian Parliament the next year, 1985. And one of the most dramatic changes is the original Concordat in Clause Article 1 said that Catholicism would be the religion of the state. And it was revised that it's no longer the religion of the state, but the religion of the majority of Italians. Now, this was a rather great breakthrough because it did recognize religious liberty, whereas religious liberty did not come about until the Second Vatican Council. And in the early part of the 20th century, and certainly through the 19th century, Vatican officials regarded it as religious indifference. They looked at it through the eyes of the French Revolution, as the present Holy Father has so many times said, as opposed to what was happening in the Anglo-American world, but especially in the United States, where religious freedom meant freedom for religion and freedom for the church. So this was a rather dramatic change. Now, it still guaranteed that there would be religious instruction in the schools and so forth. And, of course, it also was an addition to the Concordat made by the Republic of Italy, as opposed to the original Concordat, which was between the Kingdom of Italy and the Holy See.
My thanks there go to Jesuit Professor Gerald Fogarty, a church historian from the University of Virginia, currently visiting professor at Fordham University. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.